The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator, and this week my guest is the author and historian Catherine Hughes, whose new book is Catland: Feline Enchantment and the Making of the Modern World. Catherine, welcome. Can you start? I mean, I suppose a really obvious question is, what do you mean by Catland?
I mean several things. First of all, it's a word that was very associated with Louis Wain, who was a famous cat illustrator from the 1880s onwards. He often incorporated that word into his title. So it'd be Louis Wain's Catland and Feline Friends, that sort of thing. But the word had actually existed a long time before that. He didn't invent it. It was in use from about, I think, mid-19th century, where people just wanted to talk about a growing sense that the cat was changing status. It was coming out of the margins, out of barns and basement kitchens, and coming into the drawing room, as it were. And suddenly people were going sort of a bit cat crazy. And so there was this word Catland, which, of course, was used by some people in a very pejorative way. You know, Catland is a mad world where old ladies, kiddies and slightly suspect bachelors hang out, stroking their pussies. And yeah, is intended because it's there. So it's a multi-layered term, I think.
Well, it's this transformation you describe, which is kind of the thread, I guess, one of the threads that runs through your book. I mean, it's kind of a surprise, I think, to most readers. It certainly was to me a little bit, because one thinks of, you know, Thomas Gray, of Dr. Johnson's cat Hodge, even of Christopher Smart, and think, oh, you know, cats being treated as pets and being beloved companions goes right back, or goes further back. That's not right, is it?
All those people you mentioned, Dr. Johnson, Christopher Smart, absolutely are devoted to their cats. But I think it actually says something that those are the names that keep on coming up, Walpole as well, because it's actually quite unusual. It's particularly unusual for men to have pet cats. So the fact that there is a small stock of people whom I'm constantly being confronted with by audiences and slightly sceptical podcasters, I think sort of suggests how unusual it was. I mean, of course, people have always had beloved pets. Women were particularly known to like them. And yes, there was that tie-up between what was called old maids and cats, which draws on that distinguished heritage.
The mad old cat lady trope goes way back.
Way back to witchy times. There's also a sense in which the cat is a very useful first pet for middle-class children, not least because cats, for their many sort of flaws and quirks, are very good mothers. They look after their kittens very nicely. They're very clean, good nursery discipline. They'll cuff their kittens around the ears if they're misbehaving. So all that was seen as actually excellent practice for a middle-class child. But they did tend to hang out, cats, these beloved cats, in the margins, in the nursery, in the study of intellectual men, and always in the kitchen catching mice.
And what drove that change?
The change towards
them leaving the margins, you know, being named companions and so on. I mean, you, as I understand it, I think there was a sort of rise in the idea of pet ownership altogether in the 19th century. But was it just going along with that, or was there more to it?
I think there's something specific about cats. I mean, you're absolutely right. Of course, the RSPCA starts in about 1840, and that's part of a whole kind of philanthropic interest in we must be nice to our animals, to our working animals, to our dogs and our horses. And specifically, as they become pets, we must make sure we look after them as honoured guests. But a lot of people thought that cats didn't belong in that group of worthy objects of pity and concern. I mean, it's okay to be kind to your dog, who's man's best friend. It's fine to be okay to your horse, because he's either, perhaps, if you're a tradesman, he's pulling your cart. If you're an aristocrat, he's winning races for you. Those are animals, those are beings that have a claim on our pity and concern.
And a kind of working role, maybe.
A working role, absolutely. But there's a sense in which the cat is falls outside those parameters. It's really interesting. When the RSPCA wanted to have a special gold medal, the Queen Victoria medal, which would be handed out to a animal do-gooder each year, the Queen, who didn't personally care for cats very much, insisted that nonetheless, on the design for the medal, which she did herself, a cat should be included. And her thinking was, these are the poorest of my subjects, these are the poorest of the animal kingdom, and they deserve a place in there, in our hearts. Personally, Queen Victoria, I can't stand them, but I can see that I, as Queen of England and Queen of Animals, should have them there. So I think that's quite interesting.
That big of her. And I mean, Kipling's story, I'm trying to think where the cat who walked by himself places. I mean, is that sort of 1880s?
It's 1902.
1902, is that late?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
That seems to sort of articulate a real difference, maybe, that you describe between the cat as a sort of all the other animals entering into a contract with man and the cat not.
Absolutely. So what Kipling is really doing is telling a sort of origin story. I think he's very influenced by Darwin, as everybody was. So he tells a story of the caveman and the cavewoman, and the dog turns up and offers to do any little jobs around the house and help with the hunting, and the horse and the cow follow suit. And then, you're absolutely right, the cat turns up after a slightly insultingly long distance of time and says, "Hi, I'd like to make it clear, I'm not your friend and I'm not your servant, but I quite like to come into your cave." And that is how Kipling tells the origin story of the cat. But of course, what's really interesting is more than a bit of whimsy. That is actually the history, as far as we can tell, of the domestication of animals. It is the case that dogs were clearly domesticated long before cats and used for hunting and guard dog duties. Likewise, the horse, likewise, the cow. The moment we stop being hunter-gatherers and become agriculturalists, those animals are really, really key. And it is the case that the cat is not domesticated until millennia later. And some would say it's not even fully domesticated now, which I think what Kipling does quite charmingly. So the cat does, in the end, throw in his lot with the Stone Age people, but just goes, you know, believe me, I could walk off at any minute and not look back.
Yes, which is one of their attractions. It's this book that is, I think it's 50 chapters, is it?
Yes.
Which are sort of leap and zigzag in a very cat-like and enjoyable way between all sorts of different catty subjects. Tell me a bit about the thread that stitches them together.
Well, I wanted to do that very zooming around pattern, as you nicely described. So the way that cats just pop out from behind a sofa or peer out from behind a tree when you had no idea they were there. I wanted to get some of that kind of sense. But inevitably, that is going to read like a rag bag of anecdotes if that's all you do. And I was very interested in, and always have been, in the career of Louis Wain, who is this illustrator who really made the cat so popular from 1880 to about 1920. Even if you don't know the name, you will know the illustrations. That's what I found, you know, that everybody looks at and goes, oh, that guy.
That guy, yes.
That guy. And I wanted to tell his story because I've long been fascinated by it. He has this spectacular rise. He's a household name and then has an extraordinary fall into mental ill health.
When you do open, I should say, this kind of wonderful, immortal anecdote about him, which maybe is a good starting point of starting at the end. Can you describe this, this moment?
I think the anecdote is a little bit buffed up for posterity, I have to say.
But never mind, this podcast has a disregard for truth.
But how it goes is that a bit of a professional do-gooder called Dan Ryder was doing visiting in the pauper wards in Springfield Asylum in South London, so that he's part of the Board of Guardians. So there's middle-class people who come around and just check that everything's going okay. Entirely admirable, I have to say, entirely admirable. He's there just to check that the patients are quite happy. And he comes across, he says, a little man drawing cats. And he says to this little man, the equivalent of, you know, your cats are quite good. You draw just like Louis Wain. And this little man says, I am Louis Wain, which is, of course, quite possible if you're in a ward of people who have lost touch with their reason. So Dan Ryder says, you're not. And he goes, oh, but I am. And indeed, he was. And it's a great story to open with. It's also, more practically, it becomes the focus of a huge national outcry when people realise that this man who has, in a way, painted their childhood, this is the man that they remember from decades before, is languishing in a pauper's ward, which is really not very pleasant. I mean, it's like the modern equivalent of the workhouse. A huge national fund gets underway and you can send in your postal orders to try and get him out of the pauper ward. I was thinking, I mean, it's a bit like if we suddenly discovered that Valerie Singleton was in straitened circumstances now, we might all feel the need to...
leap to the postal orders.
Yeah, or a GoFundMe page, or somebody would do something. So that's what happens to the Louis Wayne. So that story is actually a hugely useful bit of PR as well.
And does Wayne recover his sanity?
No, he never does. So he does get moved into slightly nicer accommodation. They give him his own room. He goes to Bethlehem, you know, that absolutely sort of archetypal mental asylum, which is by now, by the early 20th century, is a very nice place. In fact, a lot of the inpatients seem to regard it as a bit of a spa. And the only time they get a little bit sort of restless is one summer, I think it's 1928, it's very, very hot and the lemonade runs out. And the patients stage a very polite little rebellion. But in other words, you know, this is not the Bethlehem of Hogarth. This is not people in manacled chains. This is a very nice facility. And he stays there for about 15 years before, in the last 10 years of his life, being moved to somewhere outside London, St Albans. Equally charming.
I mean, Wayne, as you say, you know, he helped to kind of create this character. I mean, how much in the sort of chicken and egg thing were his cat illustrations a beneficiary of this new love of cats, which, you know, obviously prefigures the internet? And how much do you feel he did actually help to usher it into being?
I think it's come the moment, come the man. I think it's one of those sort of mysterious things that happens in history all the time, and it's just very hard to disentangle. So on the one hand, we do have this rising interest in cats. So, for instance, the first national cat show is held in 1871 in Sydenham, in Crystal Palace. He's only 11 at that point and is apparently showing no particular interest in cats. But that's the beginning. That's the seed of a cat land that's quite external to Wayne. But by the time he comes of age and he's working as an illustrator for Illustrated London News and all those kind of wonderful middlebrow magazines that become so popular in the 1880s, he starts drawing cats. And there's a kind of recognition. So apparently, again, the anecdote goes, the first time he suggests doing a cat to the editor goes, oh, don't be ridiculous, you know.
This will never catch on.
Could you just not? No, a nice dog, I think, would be nice. Hopefully doing something sort of noble, mourning over its owner's grave. You know, that sort of Greyfriars Bobby, that sort of thing. But Wayne continues, and his cats go from being naturalistic, as in, here's some cats I just noticed in a barn doing not very much, to doing human things. So they start to walk on their legs. They start to read. They start to go to the pantomime. They develop an absolute passion for mouse pie and champagne. Odd combination. And they start to take on this anthropological turn. And it's at that point, I think, it's when he takes the cat and shows what it could be if it becomes half cat, half human.
That sort of anthropological turn in his work, I was sort of fascinated by how sort of, I don't know, maybe it's unkind to say all over the place he was, but there's a sense in which sometimes he's producing, if you like, quite adult allegories, even quite political ones. You know, he's sort of a reactionary kind of figure. And then some of it's very childish, and he sort of zooms around. Is that just a hard-working freelance going where the money is, as you see it?
That is the freelance life, which I'm sure some of us have had experience of, where you sort of do slightly tailor your product, we'd say now, for whatever was asked for. So you're absolutely right. He starts off doing middlebrow adult cats, I would say, doing middle-class late Victorian Edwardian things. So I think he starts off in the middle-class home where daddy cat is really tired after a day at work and is reading the cat news newspaper. And mummy cat would like a nice new hat, but she can't afford it because there's school fees to pay. And she says to daddy cat, I mean, I'd love a new hat. And Mrs. Jones next door has got one. What shall I do? And daddy cat says, I should drown one of the kittens. Which is just such an interesting sort of being on the cusp of what indeed did still happen to a lot of kittens. So I think at the start, he begins with that very, very interesting kind of satire of middle-class life and constantly being constrained by not enough money. And then moves, as in a way the market for that slightly fades. He gets pushed into doing what's now called stuff for the kids. Kids is a new word. I think it probably comes over from America. And he starts doing quite babyish stuff and, you know, nursery rhymes with Louis Wain or pantomimes with Louis Wain.
Does Beatrix Potter feed into that a little?
Yeah, well, by the time he's not doing so well, so by about 1910, Beatrix Potter, of course, has this spectacular rise, but being of a different class and better able to manage her money, she stops being Beatrix Potter quite early on. And she, as you know, I'm sure she retires to the Lake District and becomes a lady farmer and doesn't do any more books. So there is a bit of a gap then for somebody to step in and try and do that. And it's quite clear, you can tell there's a publisher called Valentine's that clearly wants to take Wayne, who is now a bit broken down, and wants to insert him into that gap. And so he starts doing books called things like The Tale of Priscilla Purr, you know, things which very obviously are indebted to Potter.
What was Wayne himself like as a man? I mean, you make clear in the book he was titanically successful at one point, you know, wall-to-wall Louis Wain. Everyone had a Louis Wain postcard on their mantelpiece and so forth. And yet, you know, he's almost forgotten now. And despite being a freelancer who tried to go where the money was, he was always broke, which is very hard to understand. How come?
Well, it's really interesting. Now again, because he hasn't really been written about before, so the family anecdote that was handed down was that he was just a very bad businessman. He sold his copyrights, meaning that he would do a picture, give it to the editor, and it was an outright sale. So the editor could then use it, you know, 100 times without giving him any more money for it. That's the story. He's a bad businessman. He doesn't understand copyright. I'm not sure that that's quite right. And I have to say, first of all, because copyright wasn't very robust at that point. I mean, it would be a hard case to make. And indeed, sometimes he has to go to court to prove that actually he did do this particular drawing. But also what I discovered as I started to research, which is a new area for me, late Victorian illustrators, is that a lot of them, very successful people, a lot of those chaps that worked on Punch that didn't necessarily have a staff job, but were, you know, their work was constantly in there, they went bankrupt as well. And I think there's a sort of general ignorance about copyright and what to do about it. I mean, I noticed that fine artists, so if we think of Edward Burne-Jones, Millais, people who are alive still and making their work, they know how to hang on to their copyright, but they get their solicitors involved. They don't have agents as such, they have solicitors. And I just think that somehow wasn't available to this rank of very successful, but not very elevated commercial illustrators. Actually, what I was thinking here this morning was that actually somebody like Rossetti, who one might think of as a, you know, a fine artist up there with Millais. I mean, fine in the both senses of the word, up there with Millais and Burne-Jones. I mean, he was, you know, one check away from the pauper's grave. I just think artists weren't very good at it. It wasn't really very professionalised.
Yeah. So he was broke all the time. He was of low social status, but he was quite eccentric in himself, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, even before he went completely off his onion.
It's really hard to... This was a really hard thing to write about, and I don't know if I got it right. There's a... Yes, he was very strange. He starts off... He's a very awkward child. He's born with a cleft lip, which couldn't at the time be repaired by surgery, which it can now. Babies born with cleft lips, you know, they're operated on quite quickly. That's a strange marker to have to bear. He talks about having a very horrible time at school, being beaten up, all the things that you might expect. And he does a lot of really... I used to be so terrified of these as a child. A lot of schoolroom scenes where it's usually called something like Mrs. Tabby's Academy, and the cats are just going mad. They're trapping each other's tails in trunks. They're chucking spiders and mice at each other. It's a complete pandemonium. And if you are as I was a rather good child and quite hypervigilant, it's so terrifying. You know, you just want to get on and do your homework. And there are these frightening people everywhere. And he goes back to that scene all the time. So it's clearly what I think I'm trying to say. You know, there's a sort of insecurity built in, baked in.
The school day's trauma.
Yeah, which I'm sure a lot of us have experienced. But it does also seem to be exacerbated. He starts becoming really quite strange when he's around 21, 22, which would classically, I think, suggest the onset of schizophrenia today. That's what people might think. But that doesn't quite fit because he's able to function. He has this very successful career. And frankly, if he was that incapacitated by intrusive thoughts and frightening paranoias, he wouldn't be able to do that. So that doesn't quite fit either. Other people wonder whether he was autistic. That's been suggested because he did have this very flattened affect, we'd say today. So he was the person, if you went to a party, you would just try and dodge him, because if you saw him weaving towards you, bearing down on you, and then he would talk, he liked to talk about metaphysical things like whether there was life on Venus, or about an opera that he was writing. You know, it was a man of very, very narrow interests that he would literally disgorge without any sort of suggestion of whether his company was wanted or not. So that's also a possibility.
Was Catland, in some sense, I'm thinking of someone like Kenneth Graham, for whom the imaginative creation of an animal world is obviously kind of retreat from this world, which he couldn't quite deal with. Is that same thing going on with Louis Wayne, do you think?
I'm not sure that it is. I mean, because, as you say, Graham is creating this pastoral world, isn't he, where he's very, very concerned about the encroachment of urban life and all that that means and brings. And it is a kind of lovely reverie. Wayne, to me, seems to bring in the world to his work, actually. His work is very up to date. So once people start being able to fly in aeroplanes, his cats are flying in aeroplanes. Once people start driving, I mean, his cats are driving and often having accidents, very picturesque accidents. He is full of the world, actually. So in a sense, he goes out to meet the world rather than retreat from it.
And that sense of modernity, I mean, what seems fascinating is not just in the sense that he zips back and forth according to, you know, who's paying that week, but he does change styles, sometimes quite dramatically and sometimes in response to not obviously commercial motivations. Can you talk about the different phases of Wayne's career? And also, I should ask just generally, because I'm not an art critic, but I look at most of Louis Wayne's cats and I think, this stuff's not much good, is it?
Oh, shame on you, shame on you.
Well, this is...
I don't think
he... Out
no, I think a lot of snooty critics at the time said it doesn't even look like a cat. A lot of people said that it looks like his cats start to resemble stuffed toys, which is quite interesting because the teddy bear becomes very, very popular around 1902, I think, and his cats more and more start to look like stuffed cats, you know. No, and it's impossible. They take up poses that would... I mean, I've always
thought... But you thought, say, don't you, which fascinates me, that actually his style changes and they become more sort of squat and dumpy when postcards become general.
So that's...
such a pro.
That's an example of total pragmatic kind of freelance hack mind, which is postcards come in, they're a particular shape that we all know and it still gets used today. So that's going to change the dimensions. So yes, absolutely, his cats sort of, they sort of get a bit squashed and a bit, they become cuboid, really. They become ever so slightly Picasso-ish. And he often does three of them because that works very well. You can do a sort of triptych on a postcard size. So, you know, such a pro. But what's so interesting, and I think this is perhaps what you're thinking about, he was, I mean, we have to give him credit, he was a very engaged artist in the sense that there's ample evidence that he saw all the big shows that came through London. And of course, this was the time when Roger Fry is putting on his two kind of exemplary post-impressionist exhibitions in 1910 and 1912, which is kind of modern art and which allows the critics to say, the man's mad. The man's mad. This is the daubings of lunatics, the daubings of savages and madmen. But he clearly is very engaged with that. And you can see him incorporating some of that sense into his work, that sense that proportion now doesn't matter so much, that naturalism isn't really the key, if it ever was. If you could say that a cat wearing trousers and smoking a cigar was ever a naturalistic approach to art. And then also he becomes very interested in 1910. There's a very important Anglo-Japanese exhibition at White City in which Japanese art is shown. And this is a part of Japan's attempt, the Meiji period, to open up to the Western gaze, as it were. And, you know, Wayne is fascinated by that. And he encounters, for the first time, the what's called the maneki cat. You might not know it, but it's that thing you see in all actually Chinese...
Yes, the little cat with its arm bouncing up and down.
So you see in Chinese, Japanese restaurants. I mean, it's all over Southeast Asia. And he becomes fascinated by that and incorporates that into his world. Another amazing exhibition, I think it must have been kind of thrilling to be alive in about 1912, is the Futurist exhibition. This is a bunch of Italian futurists who come in to London, and it's crazy stuff. It's everything's on the zigzag. I mean, you know, everything is kind of, is there a person in there? Is there a car in there? You really don't know. It's zigzags, and it's extraordinary. And again, as you might expect, all the right-minded critics say that this is nonsense, and it's sort of thing that foreigners do anyway, so we don't need to bother with that. Louis Wayne, who in fact comes from has French heritage, is always much more open to things coming from the continent. And he loves this futurist stuff and actually starts incorporating it into his own work.
Well, he makes these amazing pots, doesn't he? Which is a massive departure. He's certainly his avant-garde fine art person rather than...
Absolutely. So, exactly, one minute he's knocking out, you know, to fairyland with Louis Wayne, and the next minute he's producing avant-garde art. And these futurist cats, I mean, they are absolutely extraordinary. Futurists were very fond of a particular sort of orange, dirty orange colour with a bit of green and a bit of vermilion. And that's what they looked like. You really wouldn't know they were cats.
We don't have Marinetti's verdict on Louis Wayne.
Was that nice? He was, because Marinetti, of course, was the spokesperson for the futurists. It would be lovely to know. It would be so nice to know if Marinetti went, "I'm sorry, I don't know what this is." And again, dependably, Wayne has an opening for the press, and people try to be kind, and they think it's a sort of joke. So people say things like, "It's very amusing. I don't think it's going to catch on, but, you know, well done, Mr. Wayne, for having a go." And they fail, absolutely. What's so interesting is that they are now so popular and valuable in America, these particular futurist pots, that there's a thriving fakery market. So that... places like Bonham's had to withdraw a lot quite recently, where it was shown that these are not actually Louis Wayne futurist cats. Somebody had just knocked them up in their garage. I mean, isn't that extraordinary?
It is. It reminds me of that episode of Doctor Who in which they take Vincent van Gogh to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam in the time travel thing, and he wanders around going, "Oh, this is what happens after my death."
Well, you know, it's funny.
You know, you can imagine Wayne being touched.
It would be so nice if Wayne knew that. I mean, I'm not a sentimental person, but gosh, it would be lovely, because he had such a miserable life. And even when he was no longer technically a pauper, it was pretty miserable. And it would be so nice to think, actually, if only he could know that. I mean, this is extraordinary.
Wouldn't it? Just get you a bit of the background, because I'm suddenly realised we've talked so much about Louis Wayne that there's so much more in your book, and I don't want listeners to get the impression it's simply a biography of Wayne, because it's not. A thing I was kind of gripped and horrified by was the cat's meat men. You've got a whole chapter on these people, and one knows there's... I can't remember the literary reference. The literary reference to a cat's meat man is it in Dickens?
Dickens.
It's Dickens, isn't it? Talk about the cat's meat man. But that this was this whole kind of industry in the second half of the 19th century.
I know. First of all, it's very interesting because it marks the moment where, up until now, the idea was that the cat would fend for itself, even if it was a pet cat. If it was feeling hungry, it just could go out into the garden and catch lunch for itself. So just the very idea that you would buy special meat for your cat is, in a sense, a kind of big intellectual imaginative leap. But
an economic one, presumably, as well. There must be a bit of extra money knocking around in middle-class households.
Exactly. You know, it's a huge kind of shift. Everybody seems horrified by these cat's meat men. I think it's because quite a lot of people are under the impression that the cat's meat was actually made of old cats. And I have to say, it's not. It's horse meat. So what happened? These cats meet men and a few cats meet women.
I think
women.
It's maybe the idea of people pushing a cart full of offal through this warm London streets all day long, followed by crowds of cats and flies, probably.
Exactly. So say, right, you know, around here where we're sitting, St James's, all up and down the mews at the back, there would be cats meet men pushing their carts with rather scrappy and slightly elderly horse meat, which they would put on skewers. So it was rather like a modern kebab. I think it's quite charming. And they would shout, you know, cat's meat. And either maidservants would come out and buy them, or if you had a special arrangement with your cat's meat man, he would just push a skewer of meat through your door and you'd settle up at the end of the week. And I agree, it sounds absolutely disgusting because in summer, it was so fly-blown, it was absolutely horrible. And of course, cats and dogs and rats and anybody who felt like having a snack would follow them round. And then in winter, absolutely freezing. So the meat would actually freeze to the sides of the cart. So you'd have to sort of wrench it off and give it to the cat.
When did these guys cease to ply their trade? Did it sort of vanish with the advent of whiskers?
What happens is that it's actually not whiskey, it's Spratts, actually. Spratts, who did the dog food, also did some cat food. And the great thing about it, and I have cats, I have to say, and even now I love a dry cat food because it means not having to get your fingers dirty and that horrible sort of stuff that we buy for our cats, the wet meat. So what happens?
And the slugs come for it less as well.
Yeah. So Spratts starts to make cat food. Just for cats, not for dogs. It's called meat fibrine. It's said to be made of buffalo meat, which I love because it gives it a slightly sort of American tang, but also a slightly sort of outdoorsy feel. So that you're giving your cat only the best. And I think people, honestly, it was very expensive to start off with, but I think people just thought, this is so much nicer than having to deal with fly-blown horse flesh. And so they gradually disappear. Although, you know, as with all these things, not for a very long time. I mean, the cat's meat man is definitely going right through the 30s, right up to the Second World War.
Cats also have a sort of long association with sex and sexual difference, which you talk about in the book a little bit. I mean, one is, which, again, surprised me, I suspect surprised many listeners, that the slang of pussy is... You've got a whole chapter on this, so I'm allowed to broach it.
Oh, you're allowed to broach it.
It is of relatively recent coining. It seems comes in with this.
I think I'm now a bit of an expert in this. I think it's been around from the beginning of the 19th century, but it starts to codify, if we could use a proper historical word and slightly raise the tone, from about 1880, because it goes from meaning a young girl, sweet puss, to actually referring really to genitalia. But of course...
Is that a metonymic leap, or is it just a different...
It's both metonymic and it's onomatopoeic as well, because puss... Am I getting this right? I think it's metonymic.
And you describe how long before Mrs. Slocum was ever thought of. You've got this extraordinary troop of, was it can-can girls? Or...
Yes. No, this is extraordinary. These girls called the Barrison Sisters. They're originally from Denmark, but they... emigrate into the Bronx as young girls. And they're in America, they're way down the pecking order in burlesque. They have quite a sort of tame kind of act, which just revolves around them all looking slightly alike and dressing the same. And then they go to Europe, they go to Paris and to Berlin, and they get slightly fancy ideas. And there was the song Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow was very popular at the moment. So they decided to do something very similar, something along the lines of Daddy Likes My Pussy or something like that, or Eine Kleine Katze, something like that. But the point being that the finale is where they raise their skirts and they raise them higher and higher to an absolutely entranced music hall audience, and then each of them tucks into a sort of exterior pocket on their knickers, there's a little black pussy staring out. Now, I don't know if they were taxidermied, I don't know if they were drugged, I actually can't bear to think about it. And they carry on not part of their affect is to pretend not to know why the audience is laughing. So they kind of go, well, it's all in your own mind. It's a bit like Mrs. Slocum and her pussy. I mean, that wasn't meant at all. But they become such stars in Europe. Toulouse-Lautrec paints them. They come back into London where suddenly they're at the top of the bill. And it's absolutely extraordinary. And of course, some of the critics really don't know the double entendre and are quite puzzled by it and say things like, it's very, very puzzling, the Barrison sisters. They sang a song about their pussies. I don't know, the audience seemed to like it. I didn't quite get it.
Some smut just endures, doesn't it? They were also associated with gay men of the period. I mean, you talk about Edward Lear in particular. How was that sort of coded in Victorian Edwardian culture?
Cats were known. Let's go back to Dr. Johnson, Christopher Smart, Walpole. I can't remember who else you mentioned. Gray
was writing about Walpole's cat.
Writing about Walpole's cat. But let's say Walpole. Those three men are intellectuals. They're also slightly marginal. And Walpole is gay. Dr. Johnson is single for most of his life. He has a sort of unsatisfactory marriage. Smart is in the asylum, and I don't think ever married. So cats are associated with men who are slightly different. That could be because they're clever or mad or slightly flamboyant. Now, that becomes really important in the late 19th century, where it becomes well known that cats are particularly favoured by men who are very intellectual, artistic, and even, of course, that word queer, which was used in its original sense, of just being slightly off centre. And there is a word that's used, and it's a phrase, and it's not supposed to be pejorative as far as I can tell, which is somebody's a pussy bachelor, meaning, you know, yes, Uncle Harold, he's a permanent bachelor. He lives with his dear friend, Uncle Edward, and they have a lot of cats. And it's not explicit, but it's kind of, you see the beginning of a code, I think, which is about sexual difference. I suppose I was starting to think about the ways in which cats were very, very appropriate for that kind of very discreet kind of way of living. They're urban, they slip out of the household at dusk, they don't make a fuss about where they're going, they make their own arrangements, they come back in, they carry on as if nothing's happened. So I did think that there was some kind of correspondence, really, at least in tone and feel.
Yeah. Is it true that Edward Lear redesigned or built an entire new house to exactly the specifications of the old one in order to keep his cat happy?
It is true. It's really true. So Lear, at this point, is quite elderly, and he's living in San Remo, the Riviera, and he's had one villa, and he has to move because a hotel has been built next door and he doesn't like it. So he just moves about 300 yards up the road, and he decides that the new villa will be built on exactly the same plan because his elderly cat, Foss, doesn't like change, and he's really worried that Foss will just get very, very confused about the rooms and so forth. So he does actually do that, yes.
That's a high bar for cat love. We're running out of time. You end with what seems to me a sort of tantalising little coincidence that the other great cat man of the 20th century, or 20th century letters anyway, is T.S. Eliot. Does he connect with Wayne? How do you...
Eliot certainly knew about Wayne because there's a letter in the archives out in Texas in which he mentions him. So Eliot certainly knew his art. But no, there's no real connection. But what I was just fascinated by was the way in which Wayne, quite unknowingly, sort of teed up the world for Eliot then to write his great cat book in 1939, Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. And of course, many of those cats, if you think about them, the things they do, they're railway guards, they're theatre cats, they go down the river on the barge. I mean, they're living the lives that Wayne was showing in Catland. There's a sort of extraordinary tying up, I think. And I was just very, very tickled by the fact that when Eliot had his really terrible breakdown, when he has to leave Lloyd's Bank and he wants to be a poet and he's starting to write The Wasteland, and he's sent off to Margate to a hotel to recover. And of course, Margate, or one of its suburbs, is the place where Wayne was sent once he became impoverished in the 1890s. And I was just so tickled by the fact that they never met, but that they were about 7 years apart, so it's quite possible that there could have been a cat that was once stroked by Wayne, who was also stroked by Eliot when he was sitting in that famous bus shelter in Margate, writing on Margate Sands. And this immortal line on Margate Sands, "I can connect nothing with nothing." And you go, not so fast, Tom. I think I can make a connection here. And I think there might be a cat that knew both of you. And I just love that idea.
Catherine Hughes, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you.